So this is class two of what is meant to be a self-contained four-class course entitled Mindful Living, integrated, of course, into our larger retreat. And hopefully it's all jibing. Is that the word, jibing? I always want to say jiving, but that's a different word, isn't it? So, I hope it all is kind of making sense and fitting together nicely. Every retreat has the same trajectory, no matter how long or how short, group or individual. The Tibetans describe it as like imitating the shape of a rice grain. So it's sort of thin on the sides and then thick in the middle. So it takes a little bit of time to get into the whole concept of retreat, the whole experience of retreat. You know, a lot of our heads are still back in wherever we came from. And then towards the end, your heads start going to, you know, where you're going to after the retreat. So there's this kind of sweet spot in the middle. And in terms of the trajectory of this retreat, you're in it, I'd say. You know, today and probably tomorrow, right up to the lifting of silence. And then you'll start thinking about going home. And Saturday you'll start really thinking about going home, and Sunday you'll go home. So maximize this particular kind of, you know, moment here, where you can really, really concentrate on being here now, on being in the retreat and gaining the benefits of a retreat. The class last night went a little long, and I'll try not to hold you here too long tonight. It's, you know, long days, and by the end of the day, everyone's pretty tired. So I didn't have a chance to go through the exercise that is accompanying the first class. And I don't know if you did it on your own, but for the many people who didn't do it on their own, I'll review it. As I said, I think earlier, you know, ideally, I think these four classes would be done over the course of at least 4 weeks. You know, with a class meeting once a week, and then everyone goes home and does the exercise. In terms of, you know, our situation here, it would be good to spend, you know, at least 15 minutes or a half an hour on each of the exercise while you've got the time here to do it, just so that you get at least a taste of what these classes are supposed to be about. And then when you go home, there's 4 weeks of stuff to do, actually, to take home from the retreat. You know, and of course you're getting lots of stuff to take home. It's not like this is the only thing, right? You're going to be armed and dangerous going back into the world. You know, plenty of arrows in the quiver. So then it's up to you to, you know, to draw those arrows and use them. So anyway, exercise for class one, review the reading for this class and list below the aspects of your current lifestyle that are not conducive for living a mindful, meditative life. Keeping too busy, incessantly texting or emailing, too preoccupied with sensual pleasure, too loose about your ethics, or whatever. Then draw up a workable plan for making the necessary changes and begin implementing them. So, you know, yesterday's class, last night's class was really about lifestyle, you know. Are you leading the kind of lifestyle that would be conducive to mindfulness? And, you know, we went through a lot of different suggestions on, you know, what kind of place to live and, you know, all of that. And so, you know, maybe take the time here in retreat to reflect on your life back in the world. You know, and to think, well, what could I change? And be realistic, okay? Don't just go and say, okay, I'm going to meditate for 4 hours a day, and then after that, I'm going to do 2 hours of yoga, and then, you know, that's just setting yourself up to fail. But in a realistic way, evaluate, well, what kind of small and doable changes, realistic changes could I be making in my life? And this is a really good time to do it. You know, this is for those of you who had other kinds of retreat experience, you know, this is one of the really great things about retreat is that, you know, you get out of the maw a little bit, you know? You step out of your life a little bit and then look at it. You have get a little bit of objectivity about what kind of life you're really leading. And you can see it more clearly when you're outside of it a little bit. And so take a look, have a look. See if your own life is one that's really conducive to mindfulness, you know? Conducive to peace of mind. You know, mindfulness is a little bit of a buzzword nowadays, you know, which is kind of why I used it. I want to get on every bandwagon that there is. And but you know what it really means is peace of mind. I mean, among other things, it means peace of mind, having some peace in your life, in your mind, and of course it means awareness. You know, not peace of mind that comes from fantasy. Okay, because that's not real peace of mind. That's a peace of mind that's built on sand, on sandcastle. You know. So peace of mind that comes with acceptance of life, with acceptance of your life as it is, which doesn't mean, of course, that it doesn't, you know, can't stand some improvement. But be content with your level of contentment, right? Be acceptance of your relative ability to be accepting of your life, and you know, so it's a little, you know, it's a balancing act. It's a little bit of a contortion. Like driving a car with the accelerator floored and the brake fully engaged. You know? Relax and work hard. Right? Already, but not yet. So these are not necessarily contradictory experientially. They may sound contradictory logically or rationally, but experientially, of course, this is our practice. This is practice. Practice happiness means that you practice a certain kind of contentment. And it also means that you strive to improve. Both, simultaneously. No worries. You know, don't get your head all twisted up about it, you know. Stop thinking so much. And just do it. Like Nike says, right? Just do it. Alright, so here we go for class two. Class two is, it's called Mindfulness and Obstacles to It. And really, the reading from this text, for this class, is drawn from two texts. One is the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, which we've been using in the afternoon classes for the four worthy truths in the eightfold path. And this is the go-to text for all kinds of for all of the sort of major traditions of mindfulness training, you know, that go back, usually, the way we've received them, go back to Southeast Asia, actually, to Thailand and Burma, and, you know, people like Jack Kornfield and who else, all those guys, that generation, huh? Sharon Salzberg, and, you know, those kind of, you know, great teachers, Western teachers, all spent time with those great meditation masters in the forest monks, they call them. In that part of the world back in the 60s and 70s, and then kind of brought it here and integrated it into our Western life. Usually with the aid of psychology, by the way. You know, they're big on, like, you know, kind of fusing these kinds of mind training techniques with modern psychology. And anyway, so the point is that this text in particular is the text that pretty much every one of the major you know, streams of Vipassana training, of mindfulness training, and so forth go back to. It's sort of like functions for mindfulness and Vipassana in the same kind of way that the Yoga Sutra functions for yoga. It's the root text for all the traditions that derive from it. And so, you know, that was one reason I wanted to look at it with you. And another reason, when I started looking at it, another reason why I thought it was just so cool is because it's so simple. It's so simple. And, you know, some people, like, have big resistance to simple stuff. They want it more complicated, you know? They want bigger lists and, you know, more difficult, you know, kinds of meditations, and, you know. But, you know, sort of like the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama sometimes says, as you probably have heard, you know, I'm a simple monk. A simple monk. My religion, kindness. And, you know, yeah, that's all you need. All you need is love. All you need is some kindness, you know. Put a little love in your heart. That's that. You know, it could be as simple as that. Of course, then the Dalai Lama sometimes, you know, puts it into fifth gear and, you know, takes you into, like, extraordinary places. Complicated places. So, you know, meditation is like that. Meditation can be extraordinarily simple. Or it can be very, very complicated and complex with all kinds of rules and regulations and all like that. And levels, you know. We're going to get there tomorrow afternoon, you know, because in this very text it goes through like four levels of deep meditation. And, you know, they're described, you know, very, very sort of, well, not, I wouldn't say thoroughly, but they're described as what those levels are. And then we spend the rest of our lives going, what level am I on? You know. Did I get to level two yet? You know, maybe I'm not even on level one. Oh my God! You know, what a loser meditator I am. You know, and there's some people on level four, and I'm not. Maybe I'll never get to level. You know, and you just stress out about what goddamn level you're on, as if you could actually, you know, kind of break up consciousness like that. It's a little bit artificial. I mean, more than a little bit. To say that, you know, there are four levels. Or, you know, sometimes they get very elaborate. 10 levels, you know, got 10 levels. So that we have, like, more to stress out about. You know, 4 is enough to stress out about. No, have 10. See, you know, and that defeats the purpose, really. First of all, it's artificial. Second of all, it stresses you out. And third of all, it has the huge temptation of, like, you know, comparison with other people. What level are they on? You know, maybe there's somebody who's on like level 7 and I'm only on level 4, or I'm sure there are people on level 1 because I'm on level 4. You know, if you get into that whole kind of rat race, meditative rat race, it really destroys the whole point of meditation. You know, I'm not saying that these, you know, the structures are inherently bad, but they can be really detrimental if they're not understood properly. You know, if they're just understood as guidelines. They're just guidelines. You know, general, very general guidelines. Everyone's consciousness is different. You know? I mean, we actually don't know that for sure, because all we know is our consciousness. But we know how complex our consciousness is, right? And it's not easily, you know, divisible into 4 levels. You know, it's a funny thing. Consciousness is a funny thing. You can quote me on that. It's, you know, it's a strange thing. And to try to standardize consciousness, it's a little bit artificial, more than a little bit artificial. So this class is about meditation. But what I wanted to emphasize, the way I want to present it is, you know, not only as meditation. You know, I'll present it as a way to meditate, but also as a way to live, you see, all day long. And that's what meditation should really be doing for you, is teaching you how to live when you're not meditating. Otherwise, it's just escapism. It's just another way to escape. You might as well watch TV. Just escaping from reality, you see. So there's lots and lots and lots of different kinds of meditations. And, you know, they're all useful, you know, for different people at different times. You know, this is another sort of trick bag. Is, you know, some people get attached to their form of meditation and then everyone else's is crap. You know, I got the real one now. You know, finally, after all those years of learning crap meditation, now I got the real meditation, and, you know, and then all those people who aren't doing my meditation don't know how to meditate. Come on. This is just bringing all our little mental afflictions into the meditation realm. You know, competitiveness and envy and sort of pride and superiority and all of that. So all forms of meditation, you know, they have their use. In the Tibetan tradition, there's three kinds of meditations. There's three sorts of meditation, classes of meditation. There's one-pointed meditation. And this is the one that everyone thinks is the only meditation, a lot of people think. Which is, you know, you put your mind one-pointedly on anything. So, you could put your mind one-pointedly on the Poland Spring bottle. And just hold it there. And that's one-pointed meditation. So, simple enough for you? And then people will, get all elaborate about that and, put all kinds of rules and regulations around that. But it's just a matter of paying attention to the Poland Spring bottle. Or whatever is, whatever your meditation object is. That's one-pointed meditation. Then in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, they have another category called analytical meditation. Analytical meditation is where you take a problem, which is a very good meditation to do, okay? Very good. It's not one-pointed. No shamatha. It's non-shamathaistic. But it's useful, very useful. You take a problem, are you going to die? And you think about that. Death is certain. And you sit there and wrestle with that. Is there any proof that it isn't certain? You say, my death, how about that? Put the first person pronoun on it. My death is certain. And you kind of know that other people have died, right? You sort of noticed that at all? That, a bunch of people aren't here anymore in your life? But, then there's this huge denial about the fact that you're just like them. Just like everyone else, human being, you're going to die. And the time of death is totally uncertain. And you analyze that for a while. Does anyone in this room have any kind of guarantee that they're going to be here even tomorrow morning? Or next week, or next month, or next year, And you analyze that until you get it clear. This is a meditation on reality. This is a reality meditation. These analytical meditations. And any meditation that isn't referring to reality in some way or another is not that useful. Fantasy meditations are not that useful. We already do fantasy meditations, all day long, fantasizing about this or that. You don't need any help with that. You need sacred scriptures telling you to fantasize some more. So, death is certain. The time of death is totally uncertain. My death. Time of my death. You use the first person pronoun. And then the third part of that, this example of an analytical meditation, is what's gonna matter when I die? What's gonna help? My money gonna help? Is my house gonna help? How about that boat that I had to buy because everyone else in Rockport and wherever I have boats? Are my relationships going to be able to help me? Your family will cry and say, "Oh, we wish you wouldn't go." And they can't keep you, right? Is your body going to help you? All the years and years and years of grooming it and trimming its beard. See, this is why I want a beard like yours. I got to get a beard trimmer and then put it on different settings because this part has to be different than this. All this time brushing your teeth and putting on your makeup and, going to the barber or the hairdresser, going to the gym, working out, doing your downward facing dog so you can have a yoga butt. All for naught at the end, right? All for naught. Won't matter at all. Right? Anyone unclear on that? Anyone from California? So you think about it, you analyze. That's an analytical meditation. Very, very, very helpful. That meditation I did for years on a daily basis, more or less. And extremely helpful. And any time that you start to lose focus about what's really important in life, you should do that meditation. See, take that as your meditation. So there's one-pointed meditation, there's this kind of analytical meditation, there's a review meditation. This is the three categories in Tibetan Buddhism. Review meditation. Review meditation is that you take a series of steps, of another meditation, or of anything else, actually, and just memorize it. Just memorize it. So I only gave you the three-part death, what they call death awareness meditation. You can expand that out into 9 or 12. And, you know, we'll go into it tonight, but if you're really interested, it's not that hard to find online. You'll find it. Go to Wisdom's Heart, you know, or somebody else's website, and you'll find death awareness meditation. And then you learn those, all 12 of those steps, backwards and forwards. Or you memorize, like, a text, that, you know, a prayer. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, prayer, something like that. Or, you know, some verses from the Yoga Sutra, and that's a form of meditation. That's fine. That's training your mind. Mind training. And it's very useful. It's very useful to know stuff by heart. You know, many people in this room are old enough to remember when we actually had to learn stuff by heart. Even, you know, as in school children, right? We have to learn stuff by heart. Nowadays, I don't think anybody's learning anything by heart anymore, are they? And that's too bad. That was an art that is lost, is being lost. So those are the three meditations. Now I'll tell you another kind of meditation, because this one I think is, you know, the one that this text points to as a meditation, as a proper meditation, and as a very useful meditation, is to just be here now. We'll go through it, you know, we'll go through the description of it, because there's four ways to be here now. Four foundations, you know, so that we have to really, like, you know, sort of analyze again and put the categories. And am I here now in this category? But I'm not here now in this category. But I'll just tell you that in the Dzogchen tradition, Mahamudra tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, which, according to them, is the highest tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. Strangely enough, they say that. There's a form of meditation called sky gazing. Sky gazing. And it's not what you think. It's not to go out and look at the sky. It's to look at space. Because space is always here. We're always in space. We're always in empty space. And to just try to look at empty space that you're in. And with eyes open. Okay? And just try and do that. And that's an awesome meditation. That's a really awesome meditation. That gets you here and now too. Yeah. So in a sense, the meditation maybe has, you could say, has two main functions. One is to improve your mind, and one is to put you in reality. Okay. So they have the same kind of, like, dichotomous. What do you call it? You sort of. Not dichotomous quite, it's that tension that we were talking about before. Already, not yet. Relax and work hard, you see. Those two kinds of meditations do one or the other of those, right? Relax, you know, be here. Look at space, look at where you are. Go through the four foundations of mindfulness, as we will. Or, you know, like, get clear on the fact that you will die. And that time's running out, you see. And so that's a self-improvement meditation, because it's good for motivation. And so I think you can, like, you know, more or less classify all meditations into one of those two categories. Either putting you directly in touch with reality as it is, or helping you to be a better adjusted person to life, you see. Helping you in a more gradualist way to become more in tune with reality. And the realities of your life. And so you know, meditation doesn't have to be this big, complicated thing. And for most of us, I think, you know, some of us, I think, gravitate to complicated things. And if you're one of those, you know, I certainly, you know, tend to be one of those people too. And for many, many years, I thought, well, give me the most complicated meditation, you know. Make it really difficult. Lots of visualizations, and how many fingers does that Buddha have, and, you know, and all of that challenging. And those kind of meditations are really good to do when you have a lot of time on your hands, like in deep retreat over the course of weeks and months. Then it's important to, like, keep your mind active, like that. You see, engaged like that with a big challenge. But most of us aren't doing those kinds of retreats hardly at all, and pretty much everyone, isn't doing those kind of retreats with any kind of regularity. So we need a meditation that's going to work for us during the course of our day. Every day. All day long, meditation. You know. So maybe you set aside some time, special time in the morning or whenever it is, to do a proper sit-down meditation. But what we really need is some kind of way to remain mindful during the course of our day. And to learn how to take breaks. So here it is. Okay, you heard it here first. I've been predicting for a while now that meditation is going to be the new yoga. You know, yoga is a multi-billion-dollar industry. So if you can get on the ground floor of the next thing, okay, you can make some serious cash. So here, I'm telling you, it's coming. You know, already it's starting to be mainstreamed into businesses and schools and stuff like that. But the meditation that is going to be helpful for most people is going to be simple and short and integratable into our daily lives. Something that you can do, like, you know, every couple of hours at the office, you know, or on a lunch break, take a little meditation break, mindfulness break. And this kind of meditation that we'll look at tonight would be excellent for that. Excellent for that. I mean, all of them would be good. And, you know, any of them would be fine. But this one is so simple, you know, that anyone can do it. Everyone's already doing it, in fact. Everyone's already doing what this meditation says to do. Live in your body, have feelings, have a mind, and watch and have thinking going on. See, we already got that covered, don't we? You don't need anything else. You don't need any special equipment. You don't need to put, you know, OM on your T-shirt or anything like that. You just have to be living, you know, but aware. So the next text also that I'll talk about tonight as part of this class is the Bhavanakrama, which we talked to, was part of the reading from last night. And this part of this text, part of that text that I chose for tonight is about obstacles to mindfulness. So mindfulness and obstacles to it. So let's get going. So the four pillars of mindfulness, Mahasati Patthana Sutta. That's Patthana means pillars or foundation. Sati is the Pali word for smriti. Smriti means remembering. So I translated it as mindfulness, but you can remember that it means remember. That's really what it means. It means remember, like, you know, you're here now. It's like this now, isn't it? Remember that it's like this now. So mindfulness. This is the direct path, he says here. Ekayana. Ekayana. Eka means one vehicle. It's the direct one vehicle. The express train. No stops. This is the direct path for the purification of living beings. For the visuddhi of the satanam, of all living beings, sattvas. For transcending sadness. Shoka in Sanskrit. Shoka. You know, one of the great Indian emperors, the greatest probably in Indian history, was named Ashoka. It's a very nice name, actually. It means no sadness, griefless. For transcending sadness and despair, Paridevana. This is a very strong word, actually. It means something like lamentation or wailing. You know, like when you're at a funeral and sometimes people lose it and they just, like, you know, rent their clothes. Is that renting? Huh? Yeah. Rent is it? Yeah. I was unclear of all of that, because how could they've got rental clothing and they're tearing it all up. So, you know, they rend their garments and they pull out their hair. That's lamentation, wailing. So this is the direct path for purification of living beings, for transcending sadness and despair, for the elimination of stress and irritation, durmanasya, daumanasa in Pali, for coming to the correct method, for learning how to, like, live properly, and for the realization of nibbana. Nibbana is, you know, Pali for nirvana. So it's saying here that this could take you to nirvana, right here, this method right here. You know, it's kind of a sales pitch here at the beginning. You know, buy this meditation. So here are the four pillars of awareness. Chattara Satipatthana. So here they are. What are the four, you may ask? First, one who is watching the body stays focused on the body with fierce intensity. Atapi. It comes from the same word that brings us tapas. Tapas, is described sometimes as fiery heat, fiery austerities. And so here you get the idea of zeal, with zealousness, or which is a word we hardly ever use, or ardor. Is that how you say it? Ardor. 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 But that kind of intensity, you see, fiery intensity. Awareness, who's focused on the body with fiery intensity, with awareness, sampajana, which is a Pali version of a Sanskrit word that lends its name to the title of the chapter from the Guides of the Bodhisattva's Way of Life that we'll start looking at tomorrow night. Fifth chapter is guarding this kind of awareness, or you could say total awareness. Some means, the prefix means kind of whole, everything. Total awareness. And mindfulness, satima, smriti. Detaching from worldly longing and repugnance. So we talked about the two or three of the main root mental afflictions, in this retreat before. Wanting something you don't have and not wanting something you do have. Raga and Dvesha, here it's a little bit different. The two forms of discontentment. And then ignorance is kind of behind both of them. Like, what good's that going to do you? Being discontent with what is. Ignorance. What good's that going to do you? It is. It's like this now. So desire means, I don't want it to be like, I want it to be different than it is now. I want. Demand, you could say. And then aversion, or this kind of way here, repugnance, means I don't want it to be like this now. Don't want it to. But you know what? It's always like this now. And you can not want it to be like this now. You can want it to be different than it is not like this now. But it always is like this now. So he's saying here, detach from that like usual hum of discontentment. Cindy was talking about the vibrations, like all this, like, it sounded really good, didn't it? Like the vibrations that we're all, like, but most of our vibrations are discontent vibrations. I don't like it, I don't want it, I don't want it, I want it, I mean, it is, that's the hum of our lives, That's what station we're listening to. You see, so detached from that kind of worldly, says, worldly means, all the stuff that provoke it, in the outside world. So, part of meditation is going inwards, taking things inwards and getting in touch with, you and your existence here in this world, instead of always being drawn outside, to objects, to people, to events, or to whatever. So, first one is watching the body. One who is watching the body stays focused on the body with fierce intensity, awareness, mindfulness, and detaching from worldly longing and repugnance. So, concentration. Inner concentration on my body. See, I'm in my body. This body will be a corpse, but I'm in it now. She's got a t-shirt on that says that. If you wore your death awareness meditation t-shirt tonight, what a coincidence. One who is watching the feelings stays focused on the feelings with fierce intensity, awareness, and mindfulness. One who is watching the state of mind, chitta here, in Pali and Sanskrit. State of mind, your mindset, the frame of mind. See, that's what chitta really means. The frame of mind in which stuff happens, right? Thoughts happen, feelings happen. But what kind of frame of mind is it? So one who is watching the state of mind stays focused on the state of mind with fierce intensity, awareness, and mindfulness. And one who is watching thoughts stays focused on thoughts with fierce intensity, awareness, and mindfulness, detaching from worldly longing and repugnance. So there they are. There's the four pillars of mindfulness. Be mindful of your body. Be mindful of your physicality. We're embodied beings. You know, and many of us, you know, some people are like quite comfortable with that and, you know, embrace it and all like that. But many of us, you know, are in our heads all the time. And are rarely, you know, kind of, you know, only occasionally. Like when we get hungry, then we know that we're embodied. Or when we start feeling tired, or if we step on a tack, then we really know that we're embodied. But, you know, a lot of times, you know, I'm speaking about me, really. Maybe there's other people who relate to this. But long periods of time when you're just kind of like, you know, out there in outer space somewhere, you know, inner space, I guess, and not really being that aware of the fact that you're embodied, that you're an embodied being. Being aware of the feelings that you have, and we're always having some feeling. You know, some you know, pleasant feeling or an unpleasant feeling or some version of a pleasant feeling. Could be a minor pleasant feeling or a major one, or a minor unpleasant feeling or a major one, or just sort of like a neutral feeling. You know, they have a whole category for neutral feelings, which is, you know, just kind of feeling like, you know, whatever, the whatever feeling. It's like, you know, it's like if you looked at the color of this wall. If you're like me, you look at this color of your wall and you say, like, well, it's all right. You know, I'm not, I don't love it, you know. It doesn't make me really, really warm and fuzzy. But I don't hate it either. It's not bad. It's not offensive. So I have that kind of feeling about the color of this wall. You know, maybe you have a different feeling about the wall, but you probably have a kind of a neutral feeling about something else. You know, in this room or in, you know, your present existence, right? One who is watching the feelings, but maybe about the retreat, you know. Well, whatever, you know, it's all right. So you watch your body, you watch your feelings. What feelings am I having? Then the mindset. Is the mindset a happy mindset or is it an unhappy mindset? Those are the two basic mindsets that we have, and then all kinds of variations within them, you know, on the spectrum. Did you wake up on the right side of the bed or on the wrong side of the bed? You know? What kind of day are you having? You see, mindset. What kind of, like, frame of mind are you? And then the last one is watching the thoughts. You know, watch your thoughts. So if you'll notice, there's plenty to do in this meditation. There's plenty of watching going, you know, that could go on. But you don't have to watch anything that isn't happening to you. It's all just what's happening to you, right? Being attentive to your own being in life. You know, how's it going here, you know, instead of spacing out. So now we go through them one by one. Oh, and by the way, detached, right? Detached from worldly longing and repugnance. And I would say this also. Detached from identification with any one of these four. Detached from identification. So this is mindfulness is just watching neutrally, really. You know, like Cindy was saying, that you take the back seat of your own vehicle, you become a back seat driver, and just watch, like, what's going on. You assume the witness self, sometimes they say, the witness self, which just means that you, like, re-identify yourself as a witness instead of as whatever it is that you are at any given moment. Your feelings, your body, your mindset, or your thoughts, for example. You know, instead of identifying with those things, you sort of take on a different kind of identity as a witness self. Are you really a witness self? When you become a witness self, is that who you really are? So, who would be watching? Who's watching? How would you know the witness self unless somebody was watching the witness self? Right? And it's like going into one of those barber shops or beauty salons where they have mirrors facing each other, You ever done that? Ever seen that? And it kind of, the reflections go off into infinite regress. And every time you try to find a self, you know, it's like that. You know, who's trying to find a self that's trying to find a self, that's trying to find a self, that's trying to find a self, you know, and back you go. And that's an indication that we can't be who we think we are. The kind of self that we think we have is an illusion. It's an idea of the self. We have an idea of the self. But we don't have a self. We don't have the self that we think we do. And so we can have different ideas of ourselves. That's kind of the good news. Is that we can be, we can have our own version of multiple personality disorder. We can be our own Sybil. You know that, wasn't she the one that had 100 different selves? Oh, we got at least 100. No worries. You know, take on all kinds of different identities all the time. Identify with this, identify with that, identify with your job, identify with your, you know, your relationships, identify with your feelings, identify with your body. Anyone sort of questioning that you identify with your body? You know, when this is one of the strongest identifications that we have. Maybe the strongest. I mean, you know, to the extent that the self and the body are equatable, it would be the strongest, I'd say. And so do you ever identify with your body, you think? If I ask you how old you are, and you gave me a number, you have identified with your body. Right? I am 60 years old. What does that mean? My body is 60 years old. And actually it isn't. You know, because my body isn't the same body it was 7 years ago. It wasn't the same, certainly not the same body it was when I was a child. Right? So we're identifying, you know, with kind of an illusion. But we certainly identify with our bodies, like all the time. And we identify with our feelings. We identify with our feelings. You say, I am sad. I am happy. I am this or that. Then you've identified with your feelings. And then we identify with our mindsets too. You know, I am cheerful today, or I am on, you know, have this kind of mindset or that kind of mindset. And then we identify with our thoughts. So this kind of meditation is detaching from that and just watching them. It's getting us in touch actually with our real reality, which is changing, ongoing, changing, all the time changing. And not trying to freeze frame it or concretize it or grasp onto it as if it weren't changing. You see. So that's, I think, part of the detaching thing. You're detaching from all the wantings and not wantings, aversion and desire, and all the discontent. See, so that's a major thing here. You're not judging your body, your feelings, your mindset, or your thoughts. You're not saying, I don't want this one, or I do like this one, and I want to keep it forever. See, no desire and aversion. Just watching. Just detached watching. And so this is a very, very simple, and I would say to, you know, especially to the, you know, more advanced meditators in the room, this is foundational meditation. This is a total foundational meditation. You know, because this is your reality. And then, you know, if you're not in touch with your reality, all the other meditations are, you're going to be in one way or another escapist. They're just going to be escapist if you're not in touch with your reality. So, you know, very, very, very good meditation. Very simple. Very simple. Not simplistic, I would say, but very simple. Not too many things to remember. You know, no expensive Buddhas to buy. You know, no expensive, you know, meditation cushions. You can just sit there wherever you are. Stand there wherever you are. Because, you know, you're always in your body. You're always having feelings. You're always having a certain kind of mindset, and you're always having thoughts. It's always happening. And how does one who is watching the body stay focused on the body? First, one should go to a wilderness area. This is an ancient text, okay? But one should go to the forest, Aranya in Sanskrit. And this was a very, very important location in spiritual, you know, for the spiritual life in ancient India. You know, this is where the Upanishads were written. It sort of functions in the same way that the desert functions in Western tradition. So, you know, it's a place uninhabited, where, you know, you're just alone with yourself, you know. And the same kinds of weird stuff happens in the forest as it happens in the desert. Temptations, you meet the devil a bunch, you know. You meet yourself a whole lot. Yeah. Who may be the devil. And some part of us. So anyway, you go to a place where you can be alone. That's really the thing here. A wilderness area, sit at the foot of a tree, you know, like here on the ground somewhere, but alone. Or find an empty house, you know. Probably best of all the three here, you know. Just, you know, stay home and kick everyone else out. Or close the door or something, huh? Or go to the desert. Or find an empty house in the desert. Which has a tree in the middle of it. Once you sit down cross-legged, that's how people sat in India. That's how people still sit in India. Sit on a chair already. You're not in India. And you weren't brought up sitting on the floor and cross-legged, were you? Most of us, I wasn't. And it takes a long time to make that comfortable. You know, if you want to really work at it and be like all Asian and everything, you know, well, go ahead. You take about a couple, 3 years until 4 years until you're like comfortable at all sitting on cross-legged on the floor for any period of time. Or you could just sit on a chair already. You know, nobody's going to come from Yoga Journal and snap your photo and say, look at the loser meditator. You know, they're sitting on a chair. Ha, 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 loser, loser. All right? So don't worry about it. The main thing here is hold the body straight. Get the body straight. Hold the back straight. Head up, back straight. Because that helps your alertness. That's all. It's not because you look better or something like that. Or you know, and then we go, well, I got kundalini in there somewhere. I got to get it straight, my kundalini. You know, just get your awareness going. I got a serpent in there. Hold the body straight, stay present mindfully with what is happening. Hari Mukha is a very cool word. It means what's right before your face, literally. What's right in front of your face, you know. Be present with what's happening now, here. So that's the first instruction. First instruction is to sit down and to be present with what's happening, okay? And then you can make it as complicated as you want. Okay? You can elaborate that to infinity if you want. But that's what it says. Find a place where you can be alone, quiet, sit down, and pay attention. Period. That's all you need to know. That's all the meditation instruction you need to know. Now what? No, I need more. All right, so there's four things that you can pay attention to. Number one, you can pay attention to your body. Okay, oh yeah. That's the next verse, right? Yeah. This is the verse that immediately follows that, actually. You know where these little three little star things are? That means that I've skipped some stuff. But I didn't skip anything until you get to this verse. This verse comes directly after that instruction of, you know, be alone, quiet, sit down, and pay attention. Sit up straight. Sit down, sit up straight, pay attention. So there's four things. Be alone, sit down, sit up straight, and pay attention. Think you can remember all four of those? Then immediately says, mindfully, one just exhales, and mindfully, one just inhales. Which you're already doing, unless you're dead. You know, when the body's a corpse, you won't inhale or exhale. But right now, fortunately, we're still doing that. So just look at it, just pay attention. See, this much you could cut away and take it all day long. Okay, you could put it in your wallet or your purse and open it up anytime all day long, wherever you are. And take 5 minutes through the course of your day, 5 minutes at various intervals through the course of the day, especially when you're starting to get stressed out and, you know, like, if you're like me, if you stare at the computer long enough, you get all like this, you know. And this whole thing is just like a knot. And then you just take 5 minutes and go like, hey, so I should sit down. What do you tell me? I should be alone. So you close the door of your office. If you can't be alone in your office, go to the bathroom. Okay? You can always be alone in the bathroom. You know, it's one of the great things in life is that there's bathrooms. And then we don't have to share them with other people like Europeans sometimes do. So sit down, quiet, and then, you know, put your back straight. You sit on the throne in there, in the stall, and put your back straight, and pay attention to the one thing that's definitely going on. You're breathing. And just look at it. Just watch it, mindfully. Watch it. Stop thinking about the computer. Stop thinking about the job and the emails and the this and that and the phone calls that you have to, you know. And just watch yourself breathe. It's an ancient, ancient technique. It couldn't be more simple. Couldn't be more simple. And it has huge effects. Anyone who's ever tried it knows that this stuff really works, okay? You know, there's all kinds of like magic going on with the breath, okay? You know, I'm not going to sit up here and talk about it too much because I don't understand it. But there's a relationship between the physical breath and the inner energies, what they call the prana. Actually, prana means both. Prana is a word that has ambiguity. It means both your physical breathing, your actual breath, and the energies that are flowing in the inside. And this is just kind of obvious, right? I mean, everyone has had experience of this. When you're upset, when you're having a strong mental affliction, either of a negative kind or of what we think of as a positive kind, for example, anger or lust, it has the exact same manifestation in terms of your breathing. Right? Right? And when you're at peace, relative peace, it is manifested in the breath in terms of its calmness, its slowness, its fineness, refineness. And so that's indicative of this kind of relationship between the breath and the energies inside. So even just by watching them, okay, and this is not about controlling them. This is just watching. Not about trying to manipulate them like they sometimes do in yoga studios with pranayama and like that. Just watching. And that in and of itself calms you down. In and of itself brings you into peace. Which is kind of cool because actually that's what's happening. What's happening is you're sitting somewhere or standing. You know, sometimes we'll get to the body in a minute. But, you know, we're always somewhere in space breathing. And when we notice that, a peace of mind occurs. It's very beautiful. It's very, you know, kind of a positive, optimistic. It means that, like, our basic state is kind of peaceful. If we don't, like, you know, crap it all up with all this stuff going on in our heads, if we just sit and breathe, we become peaceful and happy. Happier, peacefuler, okay? And the more you can, you know, kind of concentrate on the breath, the more peace you'll get. And that's just, you can do that in 5 minutes and then get back on the job refreshed. And, okay, I was going to tell you more about, like, how to make $1 million. In addition to meditation being the next yoga, the form of meditation is going to be like this, 5 minute meditations. They're already marketing them. Lululemon's website. If you go to it, they've got a whole 5 minute meditation website thing. I think you have to like buy it. No, I think it's like you know, for the full kit to really know how to do 5 minutes of meditation, like watching your breath. I'm not sure. I shouldn't defame Lululemon. They should get a new name, though, for sure, don't you think? Anyway. It's already coming. You see, it's already being marketed like that, because for most people in this room also, that's the only kind of meditation you're really ever going to do on a daily basis, if you're honest. You know, we're going to try and get you into a habit of doing 15, 20 minutes a day. How much are you telling them to do? 15 minutes, 20 minutes, 5 minutes. See, Michael and Stephanie already got it down. They're ahead of the curve here. Yeah, you know, this is the kind of meditation and mindfulness training that people really realistically are going to do. And so this is how it's going to, this is how it's going to be integrated into our lives. Not with this kind of expectation that most people are going to be sitting on their cushion 45 minutes a day in deep shamatha meditation. You know, maybe a few people in this room are interested in that and are capable of doing it and so forth, but not many. And let alone people outside here, you see, who are all stressing out. You know, seriously stressing out because of the conditions of postmodern life, and this is the life. What do you call it? The life preserver. The life. What's that thing? The round thing. Is that so? Huh? Lifesaver. The lifesaver. Life preserver. Okay. This kind of thing is what will keep us sane. It's probably the only kind of thing that's going to keep us sane. From the constant bombardment that we're under of the media and constant communication and so forth, is to learn how to get control of our lives and take breaks regularly during the course of our day and get some peace. You know, restore ourselves like this. So that's the first part of paying attention to your body. Mindfully pay attention to the fact that your body is breathing. And it's your body, by the way, that is breathing, right? You're not you that's breathing. If you had to breathe, you'd be exhausted. There's a wonderful text, some of you have studied it, called the Ashtavaka Gita, and this is about a person who's free. This is a person who has become free in this very lifetime. And he says in this text, he says, "I'm the master of laziness. Even blinking my eyes wears me out." And you go, what? What does that mean exactly? And if you think about it, it means if you had to think about blinking your eyes, it would be extraordinarily tiring. You know, if you had to consciously be like, "Do I need to blink? Yeah. Is my eyes drying up at all? Oh, here it goes." You see? You know, it would be very, very tiring, wouldn't it? Or if you had to be consciously in charge of keeping your heart beating. What if that's a full-time job, man? Full-time job. And breathing is a full-time job too. So it's not you, you know, consciously, you know, through your will, you know, who's breathing. It's happening. Breath is happening. And that's the kind of one way to get in touch with the detached sort of witness self watching. You know, it's not you who's breathing, but it's happening. So watch it. So then the next part. When moving, one knows I am moving. When staying still, one knows I am staying still. When sitting, one knows I am sitting. When lying down, one knows I am lying down. Mindfulness of the body. What's your body doing now? Your body right now is sitting. Be mindful of the fact, I am sitting. I am sitting. I'm sitting. And soon you won't be sitting. You'll be standing. And then you go, I am standing. I'm standing, you see. It's difficult to do this. This isn't easy, okay? So in your exercise, I'm suggesting that we do this kind of thing as a meditation, 15 minutes a day as a meditation. But what he's suggesting here, what the author is suggesting here, is to be doing this all day long. So the meditation is just to train you to get in the habit of doing it all day long, of just be paying attention to your life. Now I'm sitting. Now I'm standing. Now I'm moving. Now I'm lying. Pay attention to your physical life. See? Physical life. So then we move on to feelings, I think. And how does one who is watching the feelings stay focused on feelings? Vedana in Sanskrit and Pali. This is the word they use also for one of the five heaps, Vedana. One of the five heaps in the Buddhist understanding of our being. So how does one who is watching the feelings stay focused on feelings? First, and I forgot to extract the old monks here. But I told you, right, that it's just the old monks all the time here. So you're not reading all that. First, when one is feeling happy, sukha, one knows, I'm feeling happy. And it doesn't say, and attach to that, and grasp to it, and hope it never changes. It's just like, notice it, yeah. I'm having a good day. I'm feeling the feeling that I'm having now is pleasant. I'm happy. And if feeling unhappy, one knows I'm feeling unhappy. Again, with no judgment or, you know, in this case, aversion or saying no, I shouldn't feel unhappy or I wish I didn't feel unhappy or, you know, feelings just come and go too out of our control, isn't it? You know, some people get the idea that the spiritual life is somehow about controlling feelings or thoughts or something like that. It isn't. It's unrealistic to think that that's going to happen. It's to control your responses to them. And by controlling your responses to them, you train yourself to have different kind of feelings and different kind of thoughts. Okay? But the immediate arising of feelings and thoughts, how can you say that they're in your control? I mean, have you like paid any attention? If it were in our control, why would we ever choose to have anything other than positive feelings? Why would we ever choose to ever have anything other than a nice day if it were in our control? And thoughts too. Why would we ever choose to have a negative thought? You know, negative means a thought that disturbs us. You know, a thought that brings us an unpleasant mental sort of state of mind. Why would we ever choose that willingly? See, we're not choosing that willingly. This is just going off. It's happening. And so again, the training of the detachment is actually also a training in wisdom. The training in just watching, in just being a witness, is a training in the fact that these things are just happening. You're not micromanaging your world, or yourself, or your life, you see. You know, life... What's that bumper sticker, poo-poo happens, you know? Is that the one? And it just happens. Like, poo-poo's just happening. Life's just happening. Feelings arise, you know, physical and mental. So when you're paying attention to your body, of course, you're also paying attention to, you know, the physicality of your body. Are your muscles all tightened up? You know, is there something that's, you know, throbbing somewhere, or, you know, what's happening there? But the feelings are both mental and physical, right? So your feelings are kind of like, you know, well, is this a pleasant feeling? Or is this an unpleasant feeling? If the muscles are tight, that's a feeling. You have a feeling about the muscles. No, it's an unpleasant feeling, probably. And so you just say, well, that's an unpleasant feeling. And when a pleasant feeling, that's just a pleasant feeling, just as arisen. So, you know, if you do this as a meditation, you know, you're kind of keeping track of it all. You know, probably one by one. That's how I've you know, given as an instruction for the exercise, is to just, you know, go one by one. Body, feelings, state of mind, thoughts. But of course, these are all happening at once, kind of. They're happening all the time, you know. And if you're doing this as a meditation, if you wanted to get to a more serious level of this meditation, rather than just watching them, is to watch them in a kind of a deeper way. It's not watching them, but to watch them in a deeper way and watch how ephemeral they are. Watch how fleeting they are. You know, if we don't grab onto them, if we don't identify with them, they just come and go. And this is really, really good training for living. You know, it is living, actually. But it's good training. No, it's good training for dealing with difficulties in life. So this has been another kind of, like, you know, helpful thing, you know, in my own experience in dealing with, you know, strong mental afflictions, like anger or jealousy or envy or pride, you know, round up the usual suspects, is to not immediately identify with them. They're going to come. And anybody in this room, any spiritual practitioner who doesn't think that they will always come, I think is setting themselves up for disappointment. You know, I don't know. Maybe there's a point where you'll never have another mental affliction again. That's what they say nirvana is. Nirvana is the permanent cessation of mental afflictions and their causes. But I don't know that that's possible, but I do know that it would be possible, you know, sort of theoretically, because I've had some experience at this, you know, in my own life. It would be possible not to identify with them. It would be possible to not to say, anger has arisen, but I am not anger. I am not death. That's not easy, but it's possible. Because you're not, actually. You're not anger. You're not your mental affliction. It's an illusion to think that you're a mental affliction. Mental afflictions arise. That strong anger arises. So if you can, in the moment, now we're off road here from the text is teaching, right? Text is just teaching, sit down, watch your stuff. Text is probably assuming that when you're sitting down alone, quiet, on your chair with your back straight, you're not going to have a major mental affliction attack. You know, first of all, nobody else is around, right? Alone. So generally speaking, we need to have someone else there to really get a major mental affliction attack. Sometimes you can do it with memories, but it's harder. They got when they're right there in front of your face, you know, then you can really go for it. So chances are that you're not. But this is training for when they do happen, you know. And as the anger arises, or whatever it is in your case, you know, jealousy, pride, envy, whatever it is, you know, it kind of starts down here somewhere usually. Anger certainly, right? There's a kind of like that movie, The Alien. Aliens, see that? Where all these aliens are popping out of people's stomachs and stuff like that. It seems like an alien force is awakened in there. You know, she just said my mother wears army boots, and you go, oh, you know, and doesn't it kind of like rise like that? There's an expression, Duncan, isn't there? The ire rises.
Yes.
Ire rises.
It's worse than that.
Is it worse than that? But it's called ire, isn't it? Anger.
The
gorge.
Rising gorge.
Raging gorge is like you're throwing up or something, right? Yeah. So it rises. It starts to rise. And it can rise and come out only if you've really identified with it. Only if you said, yes, that's me. That's how I feel. I feel angry. It can't really do that if you can detach from it. It's there. It, you know, it's in there somewhere, and you can watch it, and you can. But if you and the whole thing is to like not, you know, it's a fight. It's a fight not to say yeah, you know. But to the extent that you can distance yourself from the feeling, it loses all power. It loses all power, and it, you know, it does what everything does. It arises, lasts for a little while, and then it goes away on its own. So this is a very, very useful technique for all kinds of purposes. And how does one who is watching this state of mind, the citta, you know, for the Buddhists in the room, this is, of course, the same word that they use for bodhicitta. So this is also important, I think, you know, if you're into, you know, trying to understand what bodhicitta means. It's not a particular thought. It's not a feeling. It's not a sentiment. It's a state of mind. It's the arena in which all feelings, all thoughts occur. You know, it's a mindset or a frame of mind. You know, those are the best words I can find to describe it. But it's not a thought. It's not a wish. Sometimes they translate the wish to be enlightened or awakened. It's not a wish. It's the whole mindset in which all wishes occur. All thoughts, all feelings. Okay. So he's talking about the arena here of the mind, the state of mind, the frame of mind. And how does one who is watching the state of mind stay focused on the state of mind? First, O monks, when the mind is desirous, one knows the mind is desirous. So here he's talking about the... Now we get into like, well, how many states of mind are there here? And there's like three related to the three basic mental afflictions, poisons. And so here we go. The mind is desirous. The mind has raga, sa-raga in the Pali here, just like in Sanskrit, raga. Raga means wanting what I don't have. That kind of discontentment. And when the mind is not desirous, vita-raga, when it's absent of raga, when it's absent of desire, one knows the mind isn't desirous. So when you go by the ice cream store and you start to want ice cream, just say, oh, the mind wants ice cream. And when you get past the ice cream store, you know, and that goes away, well, the mind doesn't want anymore. For now, quick. For 1 second. When the mind has aversion, one knows the mind has aversion. I don't want this. I don't want this. And again, he's not really talking here about a particular thought. So, you know, I need to try to describe it better. It's not, I don't want this in particular. It's, I don't want. You know what I mean? Or I want or I don't want. Those are the two mind states, state of mind that he's talking about here so far. When the mind has aversion, one knows the mind has aversion. And when the mind does not have aversion, one knows the mind does not have aversion. When the mind is deluded, sammoha. Moha in Sanskrit means, you know, confused. When the mind is deluded, one knows the mind is deluded. And when the mind is not deluded, one knows the mind is not deluded. So this one's a little more difficult not to identify with. Feelings are hard enough not to identify with. The body is really hard not to identify with. But the mind state of mind, because that one seems so obviously me, you know. When we're thinking about the self, you know, we can kind of get the idea that I'm not my body, you know, completely. Theoretically, we can get that idea. Intellectually, we can understand that, you know, I'm not really my body entirely. Because I got a mind, after all. You know, if I were just my body, I would just be an unthinking physical thing. Animate physical thing, but unthinking. So we know that we're not just our bodies, but then when it comes to the state of mind, the frame of mind, that one's very hard not to identify with. So you just watch it, and you just say, like, I want. Now I don't want. Now I don't want. Now I don't want. No, don't want it. Aversion and the absence of aversion. And then ignorance. Confusion. You can tell if you've got a confused mind if you're unhappy in any way whatsoever. So that one's kind of our base state of mind, is confused. Anytime you're not totally satisfied, totally happy, totally content, it's a form of ignorance. So this is kind of important to relay. There is an exact correlation between the amount of wisdom that you have, which is the opposite of ignorance, and your happiness level. Exact. The wiser you are, the happier you are. And you could say the other way around. The happier you are, that's proof of the wiser that you are. There are a lot of smart, unhappy people. Lots of them. Okay, if you go to the major universities, go over to Harvard, you'll find them thick on the ground there. Really smart, unhappy people. You know, and kind of like sort of proud of it a little bit, maybe. You know, I worked in the academic world for a long time, and there was this sort of tendency, like if you came in too happy, people were just like, you know, I guess you're kind of a superficial person. All happy and everything. I used to do a lot of surfing when I was in Los Angeles, so I was out in the sun quite a bit, and I'd come into work suntanned. What are you doing outside so much? You should be inside suffering like the rest of us. In the libraries with those like fluorescent tubes that like make you think you're in 1984, scene from 1984. So this is there's an exact correlation. The wiser you are, the happier. There's a lot of smart, unhappy people, but there are no wise, unhappy people. There are no wise, unhappy people. So the mind is deluded, you know, and just be aware, any time that you're feeling anything other than perfect happiness, perfect satisfaction, which is, you know, for us, for people like us, pretty much all the time, there's some level of delusion, there's some level of ignorance going on. Then we move to thoughts. And how does one who is watching thoughts stay focused on thoughts? First, O monks, one who is watching thoughts stays focused on thoughts with respect to the five hindrances. Aren't you glad you got another list now? The four foundations of mindfulness. The fourth one is to watch your thoughts, which has five hindrances. One who is watching thoughts stays focused on the five hindrances. This is a word that means also obstacles. Something that prevents something from going on. Something that prevents mindfulness, actually, in this case. So you're watching your thoughts and focusing on the thoughts with respect to are my thoughts obscured, hindered? Is my mindfulness of my thoughts obscured by these five hindrances? Okay? So here they are. First, when the wish for sensual pleasure is being experienced within, one knows, there is the wish for sensual pleasure within me. I'm hungry, I'm thirsty, I want sex, those are the basic ones, right? And then all the various varieties that come from them, you know, all the various differentiated kinds of sensual, the desire for sensual pleasure, wish here. So this is a specific thought, okay? This isn't just a mindset. Specific thoughts. When the wish for sensual pleasure is being experienced within, one knows there's the wish for sensual pleasure. And when the wish for sensual pleasure is not being experienced within, one knows there is not the wish for sensual pleasure. You know? Just the same formula. And one knows how the wish for sensual pleasure arises. And one knows how the wish for sensual pleasure is eliminated once it is arisen. And one knows how once the wish for sensual pleasure is eliminated, it won't rise again in the future. So now he kind of takes it up into a whole other notch here. And says, now go back to the four truths. Go back to the four truths. Suffering, cause of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the way to get to the cessation of suffering. So this is the same text from which we drew that material, from the Four Truths, so here's referencing it. Then he does the same formula for what's called ill will, which we've talked about quite a bit here. Being happy about somebody else's suffering is ill will. Wishing harm on other people. And taking this kind of inordinate pleasure in it, this unseemly pleasure. And says, so just be aware of it when it arises, and so forth, and then understand, you know, how it happens and how it can be eliminated. Then with torpor and sluggishness. Torpor, you hardly ever get to use that word in English. But it's a very evocative word, you know, torpor. It's heavy laziness, right? And sluggishness. And then you run through the same formula, and agitation and worry. So some of you will recognize that here are the two of the main obstacles to meditation that we're talking about here. Agitation and worry, and then doubt. Doubt that this whole thing is worth it. What's on TV? What the hell? This mindfulness thing's boring. I just want diversions, you know. I just want to go to the movies. I want to look at my email. I want to surf the internet. I want to watch television. You know, that's doubt. Doubt is that this whole process isn't useful. Isn't going to pay off at all. So there's all different kinds of doubt. I think that's the doubt that he's talking about here primarily. There's good doubt and there's bad doubt. Good doubt is you come to a retreat, summer retreat, and you hear a whole bunch of stuff by a lot of different teachers. And good doubt is, I'm going to think about that. I'm going to take it home and contemplate it and think about whether that's right for me, you see, whether I can make sense of that, whether it seems right for me. And without that doubt, without that good doubt, you know, any kind of effect is just superficial. Any kind of effect of the retreat will just be superficial, and you'll probably forget about it in about 3 days, or you'll buy into that same kind of superficial belief when the next set of jokers run into town and start telling you stuff. And we're going to go to Pastor Ann's church, and she starts telling you stuff, and you go, yes, yes, Jesus. And then, like, 3 days later, it's like, huh? What'd you say?
I said, watch out.
Yeah, watch out. And then, like, 3 days later, it'll be like, no, I think I'll be a Hare Krishna, or, you know. So that's good doubt, just, you know, taking it seriously enough to not just believe it instantaneously and on faith, on blind faith, okay? But then there's this bad doubt. And bad doubt is not coming to a conclusion of just kind of like letting it sit there for days, weeks, months, years, decades, and just kind of like go, I'll think about it later, and I'm busy, too busy to actually like contemplate like what life is all about, how to live properly, you know, too busy. That's bad doubt. All right, so now the obstacles. This is from a different text, the Bhavanakrama, which we talked about before, Kamala Shila. I believe, I didn't look it up to confirm this, but I think Kamala Shila is probably 9th century, 10th century, something like that. In the early years of Tibetan Buddhism, because he was one of the first Indians to bring Buddhism into Tibet, and so it must have been fairly early. There are, to put it concisely, 6 flaws, dosha, for those of you who know, Ayurvedic types. Anybody study the Ayurveda, Ayurvedic medicine? Come on, Michael, you've studied, haven't you? Yeah, a little bit. Ayurveda medicine is based on the idea that there are 3 humors, or is that what they call it in Western thinking, 3 kinds of, what's another word for humor? Sorry? Imbalances, right? And that's what they're called, doshas. They're called faults. So we're made up of 3 faults. And then we try to do our best. You know, kind of balance them so that they're not really, you know, too bad. It's kind of a very pessimistic medical system. We're screwed up in 3 ways, and then we'll try to make the best of that. So there are 6 doshas, there are 6 flaws that thwart complete integration, sarva samadhi. Sarva means all, complete. And samadhi is the word I've translated here as integration. And we'll have a chance to talk about that a little bit more tomorrow, right samadhi, right integration, in the afternoon class. But I think it's very useful if we can. Sometimes it's very hard, and you just kind of give up and take the easy way out to translate Sanskrit words into English. You know, samadhi is one of those words that's almost kind of English now. Like karma. Karma is an English word, right? Yoga. Yoga is an English word. These are Sanskrit words originally. And then we kind of, forget what they mean, sort of. We think that we know what they mean. But because we didn't have to go to the work of actually translating them into our own language, we didn't really wrestle with what we think they mean. So samadhi, for some of you, has this kind of like exotic tone, like, you know, that they only probably had samadhi in India, you know. We'll try to get it here, but it's a little hopeless because we're not Indians and all, and they got samadhi and, you know, incense and sitar music and all that sort of foreign stuff, exotic stuff, and you know, because we don't translate it, we keep it foreign. Because we don't translate it, we keep it at arm's length. Samadhi. Did you get some samadhi? And shamatha's just like that, yo. Just exactly like that. Oh, like, did you get shamatha yet? Well, you know, what does it mean? Well, it means shamatha. It means the seventh layer of the sixth form of the 14th, you know, level of shamatha. So I translated it, in case you didn't notice, earlier in the reading, says tranquility. Tranquility. And that's a pretty fancy English word, but at least it's an English word. And at least we know what it means. It's tranquil. And samadhi, so samadhi, you know, maybe people would like, you know, some people wouldn't translate it this way. But it means, sort of like etymologically, something close to integration. It means that you're putting things together. That you put things together. So integration. Integration into what? What do you think? What's the only thing to integrate into?
Reality.
Integration into reality, into life. Instead of having this, like, remove from it. And we keep ourselves in remove from it. Mostly by grasping on to the I, who is different from reality. I am living in reality. As if I and reality were different, you see. And that's not integration. That's not samadhi. So samadhi is the breakdown of that kind of artificial duality between you, your process, and the process around you. Okay? They're just all process. Just all process. And to integrate... So you could also put it like this. If you wanted to be really crunchy granola, just go with the flow. Going with the flow. It's integrating. Instead of, like, you know, fighting it or saying, you know, well, I'll go with the flow on my boat. The boat of me. And I'll steer through the flow with my, you know, with my paddles. You know, you just lie back and go with the flow. And that's integration. So there are, to put it concisely, six flaws that thwart complete integration. Laziness, number one. This is an unusual, different word than the one that sometimes we're familiar with, some of you have studied. Alasya is the word that would be usually used in Sanskrit. Or lelo in Tibetan. It's the one word that everyone can remember in Tibetan. Because it sounds just like what it means in English. Lelo. Kasidya. Kasidya is even stronger than laziness, really. It means sloth. Indolence. Drifting away from what's happening. Alumba. Alumbana means support or foundation or base. So I've translated what's happening. And then... Sampramosha means being carried off, abstracted from. So abstracted from the basis, abstracted from, you know, what's going on right now. Daydreaming, the word is laya, actually, which some of you know can mean in other contexts dissolution, the dissolution of the artificial self into going into ultimate reality. Here it's a different kind of dissolution. It means... indifference or diversion. Daydreaming, I've translated it as arrogance. Audatya. Audatya means arrogance of a certain kind, disdain. So what is he talking about here? Six flaws that thwart our ability to be present here and now fully. And daydreaming, obviously, right? Laziness means just not feeling like it, you know. I don't feel like being here and now. I want to be somewhere else. You know, I want to think about the past. I want to, you know, think about the future. You know, I just don't want to be. Drifting away with what's happening is like, you know, kind of losing concentration. Daydreaming, going off on these sort of reveries of, you know, like we do. And arrogance is this kind of disdain for it. You know, I'm better than here and now. I don't belong here and now. And this is a very kind of typical spiritual reaction, actually. This is the reaction of Gnostics. You know, what are called Gnostics is that, you know, I'm a spirit. I'm pure spirit. What am I doing here in matter? You know. The main form, I'm sure you know, Reverend Ann, the main form of Gnosticism in the modern sort of spiritual mix is Scientology. It's fundamentally Gnosticism. The whole mythology is based on, like, we're aliens who are trapped, Thetans, they call them, like, trapped into this, in matter. Yeah, fallen into matter. And we've got to get back to the garden. You know that song? Yeah. We are stardust, we are golden, and we got to get back to the garden. That's a Gnostic myth. That's a modern Gnostic myth. It's an old song or an old myth? Yeah. And there were Christian, Jewish, and pagan versions of Gnosticism. It was kind of a universal, it had universal application across interdenominational or whatever you go. So this is a tendency that sometimes we have of thinking I'm somehow pure spirit, and you know, being here in the material world is a big mistake, and you know, and is beneath me somehow. And that's what he's talking about here. That's keeping us from samadhi. That kind of disdain for reality as it is, which includes material reality, being embodied and all. Not taking an interest. This is an interesting word in Sanskrit. Anaboga. Aboga. Boga means, enjoyment. And aboga is just a prefix that means, kind of really enjoying. And then an means not. Just not enjoying life. Just not caring about here and now. Because, just not enjoying it. Or, he says, the final of the six, overly enjoying it. Overly engrossed. Taken in by the what sometimes the Tibetan lamas call the marvels of samsara. The marvels of samsara, like expensive shopping malls, where you just go, wow. You should sometime visit Singapore if you get a chance. They have like the most expensive shopping malls in the world, and clean and air, and it's just like going into some amusement park for consumerists, and all the high-end stuff, and people just wander around like this, looking engrossed, totally engrossed. So then he goes through these one by one he lays it out next. The antidote to these six faults that keep us from integrating into reality as it is to cultivate eight habits. So you got six faults, eight habits. Isn't this great? Yeah. Count Buddhism, list Buddhism. The antidote to them is to cultivate eight habits which will eradicate them. Confidence, shraddha. Confidence, sometimes translated as faith, but here I think it really means confidence. Will, chandas, assertiveness, mindfulness, smriti, full attention, that's that same word that we'll talk about again tomorrow, samprajnana. It means fully attentive, fully aware. Consciousness, chetana, and equanimity, upeksha. So then he goes through them one by one. The first four are antidotes to the first problem, laziness. The first four equals one. Four equals one. So you got, because the first one, laziness, is such a big one, you got to have four antidotes for that one. So then he explains like how they work. For it is through confidence. Confidence. Like the cowardly lion got courage. Confidence. An indication that one has a strong belief in the good qualities of integration. You know, having made up your mind, okay, this would be the way to live. Integrated into life instead of separated from it. Instead of fantasizing about life, instead of daydreaming and thinking about what's going to happen or what's already happened, to really be here now fully. Having gotten that conviction, you know, maybe conviction would be the best word here. So, for it's through conviction or confidence, an indication that one has a strong belief in the good qualities of samadhi, of integration, that will arise in the the arises in the practitioner, the will. So, because of conviction, then it's like, okay, God damn it, I'm going to do it. You know, will. From will, effort, virya, is produced. And Cindy will talk more about virya tomorrow. Yeah, if I let her. We're supposed to teach together, so I think I'm... Yeah. We'll fight it out. No, of course you can do it. Effort is produced. And, you know, virya is related to the English words virile and virulent. It means, you know, again, now we're talking about strength here. We're talking about real power. So where did I get that power? Through confidence, through conviction. And through then, so then the will arises. And then this, this effort, strong effort, is produced, and through the force, the bala of effort, bala means strength, through the force of effort, the body and mind get into gear. And it's not a bad translation of the Sanskrit. It's a little anachronistic, but it means kaya chitta karmanyata, means your body and mind accomplish something. Your body and mind do something. And when there is physical and mental assertiveness, laziness is averted. Okay, then you got that get up and go. That to do what? Don't forget. To integrate into reality. To get up and go and live, finally. Instead of just always, you know, planning to live later. Thinking about living maybe someday. And get up and go and live. And so confidence in the rest should be cultivated in order to eradicate laziness. The word I've translated cultivated could also be meditated. Bhavana. So it should be meditated upon. So that, you know, you get it straight. You get it deep down. I really want this, you see. I believe it's good. I believe it would be a good way to live. Confidence. And then I really want to. I really, really want to. You know, strong desire, strong will. You know, I want to, therefore I will, you see. If you want it bad enough, you will. So you got to want it. You got to want, I want to wake up. I want to wake up to the only reality that there ever will be for me, which is here and now. Right? Not then and there. Here and now, I want to wake up. Wake up, Neo. You can like program that onto your computer, like that guy in the Matrix has. Wouldn't that be good to have on your computer every day? It's a wake up, Neo. Wake up, George. Wake up, Sarah. You know, wake up to life. So you really got to want to wake up to life if you're ever going to, you know, really have a shot at it. And then really, so then from desire comes will. And from will comes activity. Comes effort. All right. So then we've done now the antidotes to the first problem. First problem is laziness. Problem of, you know, integration. Problem that's preventing us from integration. So then mindfulness is the antidote to drifting away from what's happening. This is the second dosha, the second flaw. Smriti, remembering, that's all it needs. Remember, you know, Stop drifting away and remember, I am here now. I am here now. Tie a little, string around your finger mentally and remember. And you know you're always here and now. It's like this now, and you're always here and now. You're never there or then. Always. Right? In reality. I mean, our minds take us all over the place. But in reality, you're always here and now. And it's always like this. So remember that. Remember that. And, I've been thinking about this, for a while now. I don't know that there's any quick fixes here on how to maintain mindfulness, memory, except for to just chant that mantra. It's like this now. I mean, I wish it were easier too. I wish there was some sort of magic thing that would keep me in the present all the time, especially when it's not that pleasant to be in the present. When it's unwanted things are happening, then it's really our tendency to go, off on some fantasy. But the only way that I've come up with, maybe other people have better ideas, it's possible, but the only thing I can come up with is just to say it's like this now, over and over and over again, because it is, always, like this now. But to remind ourselves of this, there's no trick, in other words, there's no simple trick, except for to just remember, it's like this now, it's like this now. So that's mindfulness, is the antidote from drifting away from the here and now. Full awareness, samprajanya, is the antidote to daydreaming and arrogance. Flaws number 3 and 4 are covered by this antidote. With it, both are correctly perceived. So when you start daydreaming with full awareness, this is just a daydream. To really see it for what it is, instead of, again, buying into it and going, oh, let's go off on that fantasy and I'll live in that space for a while mentally. But to just be fully aware of that, okay, this is just a weird daydream that's going on. And the same with this arrogance thing, this disdain thing. It's kind of interesting that he combined these two, daydreaming and arrogance. Pride, thinking that you're too good for life, is a daydream. Rationale for it. Like, where'd you get that idea? That you were too good for life as it is, somehow. It's ridiculous. It's a dream. It's a daydream of arrogance, a daydream of pride. Anyway, that's my best guess at why they came together. So it's when you correctly perceive both of them with this full awareness that you correctly perceive that they're both fantasies. They're just fantasies. When daydreaming and arrogance are not brought into control, the flaw of not taking interest occurs. So if the daydreaming and arrogance aren't brought into control, then you don't take interest in what you're doing here and now, because you're too busy with your fantasies, too busy daydreaming. So the antidote to it is the cultivation of consciousness. So the cultivation of a full awareness is the antidote for daydreaming and arrogance. The antidote for not taking interest is remaining conscious. Conscious. Right? Consciousness is a great thing. We should try it more. We should try to remain conscious of what's happening, what's going on, consciously. When daydreaming and arrogance are brought into control, which brings about mental tranquility, shamatha, then there is the flaw of being overly engrossed. So this is subtler now. Now we're like, okay, we got the main and coarse obstacles to integration sort of covered. But when the mental tranquility arises, because of consciousness, in a way. Because you're conscious of what's really going on, there is this kind of tendency to get overly engrossed with what's going on and buying into it too much. Then the antidote to that is equanimity. Equanimity is, the Sanskrit upeksha literally means overlooking, looking over. So overlooking and gaining a kind of a peace that isn't tied to the vicissitudes of life, that isn't tied to whether things are going right or wrong, or whether it's interesting or not interesting, but just a kind of a chillaxed attitude about life as it's happening, no matter what it brings you. So that's the overview of the four foundations of mindfulness, the six doshas to samadhi or integration, and the eight antidotes. So we got a lot of numbers tonight. If you look at your exercise, please try this if you can between now and tomorrow night when we do our third class. Review the reading for this class and every day for the next week, or at least once between now and tomorrow night. Sit down in a comfortable posture and for 15 minutes practice the four pillars of mindfulness. 15 minutes. So I don't know if other meditation teachers are assigning you meditations as well, but so if they are, great. Now you've got more to do to keep you busy while you're sitting here in silence with nothing else to do. Simply observe without judgment or attachment. You know, and make sure it's like, do your best to do that without judgment or attachment. Simply observe your body and its physical sensations, where you're sitting, what you're doing. You know, feel the chair on your bottom, you know, feel your physicality. Then check your feelings or emotions. See what's coming up. And not attaching, just watching. See them come and go, actually. It's what you'll see if you watch them. Then observe your general state of mind, which also changes. Not quite as fast as the feelings and thoughts that occur within a state of mind, but the state of mind certainly changes. And you can watch that during a 15-minute session, I think. You can see. Your state of mind will improve if you do this meditation. So that'll change it. Then observe your general state of mind, and finally just watch your thoughts as they come and go. 15 minutes. Okay? 15 minutes of just being present in the here and now with yourself. Okay? And very good meditation. That's a very good meditation, and it's a good training for how to actually live. Instead of like fantasizing about living, you know, thinking about living someday, remembering how you used to live back when you were, you know, in the there and then. And training yourself to live in the present, mindfully. By the way, this kind of training and teaching is usefully combined, I think, with letting go once in a while. Of not sitting around going, what am I thinking? Where am I sitting? You know, that kind of self-consciousness is very good training. You know, it's good training to keep us in the present. But it's also good to lose yourself in the present, you know, once in a while. To have a good dance, to sing ecstatic songs, to party. And tomorrow night I'll show you a verse that says, from the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, that says you should relax once in a while and just enjoy, you know. Not just sit there like a mindful nerd. No, I think everyone's sort of seen what that kind of looks like. You know, there's whole traditions that are kind of mindfully nerdy. And they never seem to have much fun, you know? They're just also like, you know. don't know if you've ever been to the Dalai Lama's teaching and you watch the different kinds of monks that are on stage. And the Zen guys are like this. And the Theravada guys are like this. And then the Tibetan Buddhists are like... It's good to be like this, you know. But it's also good to just relax. Both. So there should be a bit of an alternation in one's practice for health, for good health and balance between mindfulness, strong mindfulness, and paying attention and just letting it loose once in a while. You know, not in any kind of harmful way, of course, but in a joyful way. That's an important spiritual practice. It's supposed to be fun, you know. You know, this was unclear to me for many, many years because I never had much fun going to church. I'll tell you what, nobody else did either, as far as I could tell. Yeah. So you got to go to the right church. But it's supposed to be fun, and it's supposed to get funner until it gets to be the funnest. And that's the goal, nirvana, the funnest. Salvation, enlightenment. It's the funnest. It's supposed to be happy. It's supposed to be happy. That's the whole point. So let it loose once in a while. But learn, I mean, you know, most of us are letting it loose all the time without any mindfulness whatsoever. See, going through all day long without any mindfulness. So letting loose assumes that there's some mindfulness that you're letting loose from. You know what I mean? All right, see you tomorrow.